There we go.
So, the questions for today. The last question. Dear Ajahn, how to deepen kindness and respect to one's process? If you can't come here, then you go to Nalamara Center. If you can't go to Nalamara Center, go to Dhammasara or Bodhinyan. If you can't go to those places, there are many other, what I call, franchises we're opening up in the world. NBM, our Melbourne franchise. And what, Santi? Our Sydney franchise. Maybe South Australia. Our Adelaide franchise. Maybe she's from South Australia. Where else we can go? Colombo franchise, Ajahn Brahm Center, Singapore Buddhist Fellowship, Malaysia Buddhist Gem Fellowship, so many franchises opening up in the world that we nickname them McBrahms. No, we don't nickname them McBrahms. But anyway, it's just practice is the only way to deepen kindness and respect. And remember, kindness takes a lot to actually to develop. But one little moment of negativity or anger getting fed up is destroys so many days of kindness. So when you do have some kindness and respect, please guard it. Just like a little flower which is growing or a young sapling tree, don't get it destroyed because it takes so long to develop, but it's so easy to sacrifice. Because things don't go your way. Because you expect from the world what it can't give you. And then all the kindness and respect and the peace just goes away. So please also develop some wisdom. And also, the more you devote to kindness and respect, the more it grows. The quieter my mind becomes, the more awareness I have. And I can see that my body is not very still. It is constantly moving, although very subtly, thoughts. Straitjacket. That will keep your body absolutely still. Actually, we haven't got any yet, but maybe we'll get a collection up afterwards and get two or three. I think I can know a few people who could use one. Tie you to the chair. That will stop you moving. Okay, it's good that you, that's only joking, you can see that your body is moving. That's mostly the problem. You haven't been able to see it before. Once you see the body moving, again, mindfulness offers you the opportunity for feedback. What makes the body move more? What makes it move less? If you do scratch your eye, do you have to scratch it again? And often that's what you have to do. It's like your body is, you know, giving you a call. Are you in? Now please, scratch my nose please. And so you scratch your nose and then the body knows you're in. So I said, can you please scratch my mouth? Can you scratch my temple? Can you scratch me on the knee? And just no end to answers. And questions rather, and requests from your body. So sometimes you just say, nope, that's it, I'm out. I'm not going to follow your commands, body. It says, you know, scratch the ear, no. Come on, scratch the ear, no. Scratch the ear, please. And it gets more and more itchy. And then when the body realizes you're not at home, then it sort of shuts up. And you don't have to scratch your ear, you don't have to scratch anything. So there is a time for restraint. You say, no, just too much scratching. And it just makes it more itchy. So that's actually how you keep the body still. There is moving the body when you really need to move the body. You're in great pain or aches, fine. But a lot of time, it's not really pain, it's not really aches. It's just a tiny irritation, mostly caused by restlessness. So that's how you get your body to be still. Next one. Unfortunately, the anger-eating demon had mutated these days. Oh, that's interesting. The more kindness and gentle we treat them, the more bullish they become. At the time we have to hiss back, it appears that kindness doesn't always work. Are we not getting the root cause right? Any comments, Ajahn? Thank you for another great retreat. It really depends what the anger eating demon is, but most time, if you have a lot of patience, and if you have, you know, enough commitment, then the anger eating demon usually, most things are anger eating demon, most things usually are just conquered by such kindness. So if you have big problems in meditation, sometimes people would say to me, they have what they called an attack of all the defilements, all at once, every hindrance. They say, come to them. Oh, I don't know how they can do this. I don't know how you can have restlessness and sloth and torpor. But nevertheless, they say, everything comes to me all at once. I'm going crazy. And that's when I reply to them, you should follow the Nalagiri method. So the story of Nalagiri, the elephant, is a classic Buddhist story. The Buddha, even though such a kind, wonderful person, even some people hated the Buddha. It's always like that sort of idea, because it means if people hate you and hate me and they don't like me, someone's going to dislike you. They even dislike the Buddha, so what chance have you got? Someone's going to dislike you. So they tried to assassinate the Buddha. And one of their methods was, they had this huge elephant and they fed it whiskey until the elephant was absolutely drunk and crazy, didn't know what he was doing. And then they let the elephant go, charging down the path. Now, if any of you have been to Europe, the same with the back streets of Indian cities, they're really tiny. Because in those days you didn't need to have big, wide roads for cars. They were just at most like horses or people just walking. So the streets were very narrow. And there they let the elephant down these narrow streets. And when people saw this elephant charging towards them, they had to jump over the fences, go inside their houses to hide, because this was a dangerous, pathological killer of an elephant. Psychotic was the word I was supposed to be using. I don't know if elephants can get psychotic, but that's the nearest you can get. And anyway, in the opposite direction, early in the morning, the Buddha was walking with his monks, peaceful and kind, receiving alms food from the faithful out of compassion for their welfare, so they can make lots of good karma. In the opposite direction, Nalagiri was charging towards everybody, and people were running away. And then the soft Buddha was coming up. And people were shouting at the Buddha, get out of the way, get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming in your direction, get out of the way, quick. And the Buddha just carried on walking peaceful. And so did Ananda, his faithful attendant, who would never leave the Buddha in any danger. And all the great monks, they were running over the wall, hiding in the houses, anything, climbing up the trees. They all scarpered quickly. And so, as the elephant was coming closer, charging along, smashing this, smashing that, there was the Buddha and Ananda coming. I don't know if you ever saw that film, The High Noon. That was where these bad guys and the marshal were coming together. And that's what it was, like the original High Noon in India 2,500 years ago. You know, instead of the bandit, I think it was Gary Cooper, wasn't it, I think, if I remember correctly? Anyway, he was a marshal. Instead of the marshal and the bad guy, it was the Buddha, the marshal of the Dhamma, and the bad elephant coming together. And Ananda. Ananda would sacrifice anything for his teacher. He walked in front of the Buddha, let the elephant take me. I will protect my master, the Buddha. And I, at this point, when I tell the story, I often ask, how many of you would do that for me? Probably none of you. You'd also be up the trees as well. Any of you monks would do that? No. That's the thing with being a monk, to be honest. So, and it wasn't necessary anyway, so the Buddha just... That's the trouble with being your honest monks. Very embarrassing. But anyway, so The Buddha gently pushed Ananda out of the way. Very nice gesture, but I can handle this. So Ananda's moment of glory was taken away from him. So there was just the mad, raging, psychotic elephants charging and smashing and squashing, and the Buddha walking very calmly. Now, what would happen when the Buddha, the symbol of incredible peace and kindness, met the huge, powerful, super strong, psychotic elephant, the symbol of rage and stupidity, when they come together, what would happen? And of course, you know what happened. You know, if something else happened, it wouldn't be the Buddha, and I wouldn't be able to tell the story, and I wouldn't be a disciple. And so, anyway, what happened? What happened? Two things could have happened. The first thing, now, there are such things as psychic powers. I've seen some of these things in my life. A nice aside for you. A juicy psychic power. I couldn't tell this until the monk in question died. There was this Indonesian monk. And he was a very powerful monk. He had psychic powers. And one of my disciples, she went to one of his meditation classes in Wat Bawan, in a temple in Bangkok. And just like you, they were doing a group meditation, and she knew that something was up. Even though she had her eyes closed, she knew that something strange was happening. And she opened her eyes, and what she saw, she told me afterwards, really spooked her. Never seen anything like this in her whole life. Out of this monk's eyes were coming laser lights going into another meditator. Just like in the movies, but this was real. No, this is no Gomayang. This was actually real. This monk had his laser eyes. He can actually just go right in. And people could see the lights coming from his eyes into another person. Now that is cool. They have those things in the movies, probably, but this is a real thing. The monk with special effects, but real. So, you know, there are these. So the Buddha could have got out his laser lights and zapped Nalagiri. Just one look, and it could have gone up in a puff of smoke. Or, what I usually say, you know, just, you see all these kung fu masters these days. I mean, kung fu started as Buddhist monks, so the Buddha should have known some kung fu or something like that. Anyway, I thought the Buddha very quickly could have grabbed the elephant's trunk, really quickly, lit it up, swirled it three times around his head, and thrown him over the Ganges River about 200 miles away. That would be easy, just like easier squatting a fly if you wanted to do that. But the Buddha wasn't violent. He didn't zap him with his laser eyes or throw this poor elephant over the Ganges. Instead, he radiated loving kindness. Now, if you think you can do loving kindness, or some of the great monks I've met, imagine a Buddha. Wow, that would be really mega power, sort of loving kindness. And so I imagine the Buddha would have done something like, Nalagiri, little elephant, the door of my heart is fully open to you, no matter what you ever do. You can squash me into hamburger patty with your big feet. You can take me up in your trunk and smash me against the tree. But even if you kill me or injure me, I will always forgive you and love you and care for you. Because Nalagiri, my compassion to you is totally unconditional. Something like that. And that type of loving kindness is so powerful, it's irresistible, that Nalagiri slowed down. And when he came right in front of the Buddha, close enough, Nalagiri bowed his head and the Buddha stroked his trunk. There, there, Nalagiri. There, there. And that's how the Buddha defeated the great elephant Nalagiri. Not with psychic powers, not with brute force, but with compassion. So if you have a crazy mind with all the hindrances and all the obstructions smashing everything around, what you say to it, mind, the door of my heart's open to you. You can drive me crazy. You can make me absolutely stupid and embarrassed. but mind, I'll always care for you. Demon, monster, you can smash up my palace. You can destroy everything I built. The anger-eating monster, I really care for you. And then that anger-eating monster will become so kind to you, it will be bowing in front of you, and you'll be stroking its enormous nose. There, there, monster. There, there. And that's actually how it works. Kindness, when you do it properly, nothing can resist its power. There has to be unconditional, not asking anything back in return. And that's why I admire that story of the Nilgiri the elephant, because it really works. There's times when, you know, just everything you try doesn't work. So try that one. Okay, mind, I can go crazy. I can end up in the funny farm. That's okay. Mind, I'll always love you. That works. Next question. Can you please explain why you say meditation is good karma? Because when you're meditating, you can't kill anything. You're not paying any attention. You cannot steal because you're not moving. You cannot commit adultery. I've never seen anyone commit adultery while they're meditating. Maybe thinking about it, but please don't do it. So you can't obey that precept. You can't lie because you're silent. And you can't drink alcohol or take drugs when you're in meditation. So, 5 precepts, automatic when you're sitting in meditation. There's so much stuff you can't do when you're sitting still. So number one, you can't make much bad karma. And number two, you are creating such a beautiful mind. That beautiful mind, when it comes out of meditation, can do wonderful things for other people. Now, I could only build this place because of meditating before. And you said all the people who've come together to really work hard to make this place, they're all meditators. Without their meditation, we wouldn't have a place like this. So what great good karma that was. So, and it's also when you develop beautiful states of mind, you know, things like letting go, generosity, kindness, service, that becomes the foundation of all the good karma you do later on. Or, to put it bluntly, there are so many women, mostly women have told me this, that they come to the meditation class and they tell me afterwards they never felt like coming to meditation that night. They were busy working. When they came home, they just wanted to put their feet up, have the dinner and just maybe watch something on the TV. They were just so tired. But it was their little daughter who said, "Mummy, please go to meditation. I don't feel like it, darling. I'm tired. Mummy, please go to meditation." "No, not tonight. Mummy, go to meditation." "Why, darling?" "Because you're so much nicer, Mummy, when you come back from meditation." The kids notice it. So out of compassion to all the people, especially the kids, who have to put up with you, meditation makes you softer, wiser, more compassionate, more peaceful, a much better mummy. Or, like, this was some time ago, there was this another lady who, her husband. And this was the first years when we came to Perth. He always wanted to go on one of our weekend retreats. We don't do weekend retreats in those days. And he asked his wife, "Can I go on a weekend retreat?" She said, "No way. You can't leave me with the kids. We've got to take them to sport. We've got to take them to the dentist. We've got to do the shopping. And you've got all those chores in the house to do. No, you're too busy. And I'm too busy too." So he was a very good husband. He said, "Okay, darling." And he helped her all weekend. "Next time there's a retreat, can I go on a retreat?" You know, the same thing. "Oh, no, mother's coming this weekend. You've got to fix the gutters. You know, someone's coming around to just have a look at the air conditioner." "No, too busy. I need you." But he'd always say, "Okay, darling." He would never argue with her, but he was so persistent that apparently, he told us this, we all laughed, this was Ajahn Chakra when he was around, He asked the one, "There's another weekend retreat, the Buddhist Society, West Australia, can I go?" And she was so fed up with him. She said, "Okay, you go off to your stupid retreat and leave me with all the work." So he did. He took that as permission. And what happened next was when he came home, he was such an improved version of a husband that she was so impressed that he told us that the next time there was a retreat on, he never needed to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. She liked, you know, the husband which came back from a retreat. She appreciated that so much, which is why she kept sending him. And so that's actually why it's good karma. Other people appreciate it probably more than you do. When you go back home to whatever place you came from, you will find that people say, "Wow, you're so much more peaceful and happy. Well done." During meditation, does the mind stay in fully awakened state or half sleep, half awake state? It can't be half asleep or half awake. You're either awake or you're asleep. But in the meditation, when you get into deep meditation, you're super awake. So it's not half awake, it's like double awake, triple awake, a really mega awake, exponentially 10 to the million to the 64th awake. That's how awake you are, really, really super awake. And it's wonderful. The more you are awake in the meditation, the more energy and the more bliss you have in the mind, the closer you are to Nirvana. You know what the word Buddha means? It does not mean enlightened one. The word Buddha comes from a Pali word called Bujati, which means to wake up. When people say the awakened one, now that is accurate to the original Pali word. And so it's a great term, the awakened one. Are you awake yet? We feel, we're not asleep, we're not in bed. But no, if you really get into deep meditation, you are awake, baby. You're awake right now. You know, you think you're awake, but you're half asleep. It's totally amazing energies. And you can't go to sleep. Powerful. And whatever you see it so much more detail. What you hear, you can hear so much more. And your body is alive with feelings. And so, only what you see, wow, that floor is amazing. So this is actually what awake means. Really strong mindfulness. And that's why it's called the Buddha, the fully awakened one. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for your support and inspiration. My gratefulness to you is beyond words. Well, why do you write the note then? This is really illogical, human beings. I would like to point out how very loving, caring and hard-working Bianca has been. BSWA is very lucky to have her. Is she here tonight? No, she's not. I'll leave this till tomorrow. So when she's here, I can read that out to her. It is actually, it's amazing just how many really good people, you know, are attracted to this Buddhist society over here. And it's just like, it's like beautiful butterflies come to the most beautiful gardens. I think that's probably that we attract such amazing people. You know, this is her holiday. You know, time off, and she spends it just working her butt off for you guys. And you ask her, "What do you do that for?" Because she enjoys it. Fun. Joy, happiness. We always think that on our holidays, I just go to Bali, go to Broome, go to the Gold Coast and have a nice holiday. Well, wise people know, I'm going to do some service on my holiday. And they get so much happiness out of it. It's amazing. At this stage of a meditation retreat, I often feel the urge to make funny faces at myself in the mirror. Is this a manifestation of joy, or is it the dual ego trying to express itself? I think you're going crazy. We have to send you to a psychiatrist. No, you're not. You're fine. It's great that what's happening is you want to make funny faces yourself in the mirror. What's happening? You're letting go of some of your ego. You know, you don't really worry about, you know, what you look like. And that. because a lot of times people aren't sort of, can't make fun of themselves, they can't enjoy, they can't have laughter because of the sense of self and ego. You know, sometimes that's quite difficult to tell a joke because, oh, what if people don't laugh? What if they don't find it funny? That'd be very embarrassing. But when you sort of lose your ego, you know, you're not embarrassed at all. Do whatever you like. Imagine, like, you know, you're quite lucky these days, the nuns, you know, you can dress like that, people know who you are. When I first came to Perth, they didn't know who I was. And they would say, what are you dressed like a girl for? You go to the, you know, the public toilets. And they say, no, you're going through the wrong door, madam. That one over there. It was really fun being a monk. This was all that time ago. I didn't know who you were. So, but now everyone knows what a monk is, what a nun is, and so it's, you know, it's not so much fun anymore. So anyway, but you didn't worry what other people say about you. In fact, you know, when they say terrible things about you, you know, one of the worst, I still makes me laugh, poor old Ajahn Sumedho. Now, he's an elderly Western monk, still alive, but it's very old now, and he's in Thailand. And, how many years ago was this? Maybe I was a monk about 8 years. And I went to visit England, and he was taking me I was his attendant to a little Dharma tour of the north of England. We're in the town of Doncaster. And it's, you know, it's really a run-down town at the time. And in the morning, we went for a walk, a bit of exercise before lunch. And as we were all just walking, just talking to one another, this gentleman, like a business guy, you know, in a big business suit, you know, bowler hat and furled umbrella, you know, really sort of maybe 50, 60 years of age, he came up to us and looked at us with utter disrespect. And he looked at Ajahn Sumedho, who was much older than I, and he said to him, "You, sir, are old enough to know better." And walked away. It was such a put down. I just really didn't know how to answer that one. It was a great put down. As if, you know, I was young and could do stupid things like dress like a monk and stuff, but, you know, he was old enough to know better. So, but anyway, that's the, you know. And what was the other put down? A few years later, when I was in most of my family came from Liverpool. The other ones came from the town of Stoke-on-Trent in the Midlands of England. So I was visiting some family in Stoke-on-Trent. And again, you know, in the morning, go for a nice walk, have some exercise. And as I was walking down the streets of this town in the middle of England, you know, people were actually pointing at me and laughing. I mean, really laughing, you know, belly laughing. And, you know, I didn't mind making people happy, but I've never encountered that ever before. Now, most other sort of parts of England, if you walk down the street, people don't like you, they just, you know, cross over the other side of the road, or, you know, they just, you know, they pass you looking down and afterwards look back, you know, once they pass you when you think you're not looking. So, but everyone was actually pointing and laughing at me, and even the kids were pointing and laughing at me. And I've never seen that before. And then I just walked around a corner, you know, with my cousin, and then we found out why they were all laughing at me. Because there was a big billboard. The circus was in town. And they thought I was one of the clowns. That's why they're laughing at me. Well, but anyway, I like those stories. I'm not embarrassed. It's just more sort of material for my talk. So, often fairly urged to make funny faces at myself in the mirror, great. And go to the next stage, make funny faces at other people. Next. Even though Sri Lanka is a third world country, is it? People are extremely generous. They donate all valuable stuff to monks. What would you do if someone donated you a Mercedes-Benz for your own use? Wow, a Merc. You know, someone once, I told them I'd really like a Ferrari. They gave me a Ferrari once. A little toy one about this big. They were just messing around. I was messing around with them. If someone gave me a Mercedes-Benz for my own use, what I would probably do is say, thank you very much. and then I would flog it and buy a small second-hand beat-up old car, which is what we've got these days. And this poor monk, Venerable Chanda, he's the one who has to fix all our cars, is up. So when I would do this, he's really upset. He said, why didn't you please accept the Mercedes-Benz, because then I don't have to keep fixing it up. And then give the rest of the money to a good cause, like one of our monasteries. We're always building something somewhere. So one of the places we're building up now is a new monastery in England. It's MacBrahams in UK. So anyway, that's what I'd probably do. But I would not refuse it. I'd accept it. Because when people make a generous offer, it's such a beautiful thing that I would always accept it. This was a story I read so long ago. This was a story of the Dalai Lama before he was famous. He was still in Tibet at the time. And as a young sort of leader, he would go to different villages in Tibet, to see people. And wherever he went, there was a whole line of people would line up to give him stuff. And on this tour, there was an American journalist who was doing an article, a really early article on the Dalai Lama. And he was getting more and more upset, more and more angry. Because these were dirt poor people giving expensive things to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And just what, the straw which broke the camel's back, as they say, was when this really penniless woman, when she lined up and when it's her turn to give the Dalai Lama something, she gave him a skirt. A dirty old skirt, but probably the best piece of clothing she had. And the journalist, said, what on earth are you doing? You call yourself a holy man? You're Dalai Lama, you can get whatever you want. Now this lady, you can't wear skirts, you're a man. She needs it much more than you. Why on earth are you taking this from this poor lady? And the Dalai Lama, whenever people get angry at you, just be quiet and agree with them. Says, actually, you're right. That really sort of takes away people's anger when you agree. Oh yeah, actually, you're right. But then he added something extra which the guy hadn't seen. He said, yes, you're right. I don't need the skirt. But this lady needed to give it to me. That's why I accepted it. And I will give it in the next village to another poor lady. But the reason I accepted it, because she needed to give it to me. And that actually opened up the meaning of generosity. Of course I don't need a Mercedes-Benz. But somebody might need to give it to me. Thank you. And then I'll give it to somebody else. Or sell it and the rest of the money goes to Nudge Monastery or something. I won't get anything out of it. But that fellow needed to give it. And that's really important. Which is one of the reasons why I told the story about the socks. This Sri Lankan lady, not Mercedes-Benz socks, just ordinary socks, she needed it herself. I didn't need socks, but I accepted it because it made her happy. She needed to give me something. And I accepted it and then gave it on. That's actually how it all works. So especially if you're nuns, if people give you something, please accept it. Even if you don't need it. And then give it on to somebody else afterwards. That's actually how it works. Can someone hear noises when they are in a jhana? Not at all. If you are in a jhana, be careful if you're in a jhana tomorrow. You will not even hear sadhu, 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 especially if the nuns say it. Can't wait to do better next time. You won't be able to listen to our chanting. You won't be able to hear anything. Because in jhana, the whole five senses are totally gone. So what happens if there was a fire? You wouldn't be able to hear the fire alarms. You wouldn't be able to get up. What would happen? Would you get burnt? Would you get fired? There's a story in the suttas of this monk who was in jhana in the forest. And these two villagers came by searching for some herbs or something in the forest. And they saw this monk sitting perfectly still in the forest. He wasn't breathing. And thought, oh my goodness, the monk is dead. What should we do? Should we take him back to the monastery, or what should we do? But it's too far. He said, well, You can't just leave a dead monk in the middle of the forest. You'll get eaten by the animals. The only respectful thing to do is let's cremate him right here. And it was in the forest. There's lots of wood around. So it didn't take that long to, you know, grab some fallen logs and some branches and make a funeral pyre and respectfully lift the monk on top of the pyre and then light it. And they found some chance, which they thought they knew, something to make it, you know, some sort of ceremony. And they lit the fire, the monk on top, and once the fire was established, you know, they were busy people, they went off to do their business, you know, because the fire would burn the monk. And the next morning, they were really impressed when they saw that same monk come walking for alms in their village. No marks on his robes. His robes were intact, no char marks, because when you get into jhanas, you cannot be burned. Even if, you know, you're wearing your clothes don't get burnt either. So, if ever there is a big bushfire and you're caught in Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, get into jhana quickly. And after the fire passes, then you can come out of jhana and be safe. No worries. That's our bushfire plan. People just don't appreciate this, and just the local council just will not accept it. They're just so disbelievers. It's true. That's a true story. And so, if ever, you know, if ever you go in jhana, you don't have to worry about anything. Okay, they think you're dead, and they put you in the box, and they take you to the crematorium. They put you in the ovens, and after, you know, the guy puts you in the ovens, he opens the door a couple of hours later. Hi, I'm still here. You can't get rid of me that easy. You still alive. So that's, you know, you're totally safe in jhanas. When I try to send kindness to my body to aches and pains, the parts of the body that are sick to the hindrances, I notice that I usually have a secret ulterior motive. Secretly wanting to get rid of these things. I know that this isn't what I'm supposed to do, but I don't know how to do otherwise. I have failed in sending kindness to myself. Please help. Yeah, it's true, but at least you've noticed. You've got aches and pains in the body, and they are sick, and you want them to get better. That's quite natural. That's just kindness to your body. But what makes it worse? What makes it better? And if you really demand that they get better, you really expect it to get better, you really crave for it to get better, then of course it gets worse. But if you just let it be, it's just an ache, just a pain. We all have pain somewhere or other, and you might as well get used to them now because they get worse as you get older. I always say that after you get to about 40, you're starting going downhill, which means all of you, except for one or two, you're all over the hill. And I also notice whenever you go over the hill, the further you go from the summit, the more you pick up speed. It's true. So it gets faster and faster. The distance from 40 to 41 is, you know, is quite long. From 50 to 51, it's much shorter. 60 to 61, it's just a few moments. And it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. As you're rushing headlong, speeding, picking up speed to your coffin. I can see it coming over there. And it's coming faster and faster and faster. So anyway. What's that question there? Oh, yeah. So, there we go. So send kindness to your body, but with no strings attached. Unconditional kindness is what works. Kindness with a small print at the bottom, you know, like you have in contracts. That doesn't work. It has to be unconditional loving kindness. Like the Buddha to Nalagiri. Nalagiri, it doesn't matter if you kill me, I still love you. So say that to your aches and pains. If you cause my death, doesn't matter. I'm still kind to you. And then things start to disappear. Maya, please take the opportunity to express are, mine and my wife's, very sincere thanks for your great but simple teachings, please. But have you got your wife's permission, first of all? Because sometimes men speak for their wife without actually getting their wife's permission, because there was this story I love telling. This is totally sexist, but this is not Buddhism. This was Islam, Sufism. Because there was this Sufi saint called Nasruddin. Really great stories. And they had like a holy man in their town. And their holy man started getting really sick. And of course, you know, he's such an important person for them. He was so wise, compassionate, taught them everything. So that when he got sick, they got a collection together and got the best doctors, you know, from the main cities to come and visit, to try and keep this really wonderful saint alive. But even after all the best doctors, they said, sorry, he's dying. So they had a big meeting of all the people in the town, all the guys, you know, who were trying to get some money and really cared about this guy, big meeting. So what are we going to do? You know, this important person for us is going to die. We don't know what we're going to do without him. And somebody had this really big good idea. And he said, I know what. I am going to donate one day of my life. No, Allah, please take one day off my life and give it to the saint. And they said, wow, what a good idea. And somebody else put their hand up there. 2 days. 3 days, somebody else said. 4 days, they said, I'll give off my life so this saint can actually live a bit longer. Because that way, you know, we get lots and lots of more days and he will live much longer. And this, Mullah Nasruddin, he put his hand up, I give 20 years. And everyone in the hall went totally quiet. You sure? That's a lot of time. 20 years. Have you really thought? Yeah, 20 years. Are you really sure about that? He said, no problem at all. I give 20 years of my wife's life. For this guy. That is so sexist. I agree, but it's funny. Come on. In those days, that's what they would do. They would do. Guys, okay, you've been married to them. You should know by now. So anyway, express my sincere thanks to your great but simple teachings. No doubt you will either meet up with Venerable Pukusati, who meditated all night with Lord Buddha in the potter's workshop. Oh yeah, that was the name. And got killed by a cow and got reborn in the Pura pose, or may disappear even bypassing him. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, it was Pukusati, that was his name. And in those days, when, you know, people got really sort of great teachings from the Buddha, they usually died pretty quickly afterwards. So we don't have cows here, but you maybe get sort of gored by a kangaroo. Is that possible? I don't think so. Could you please put all the retreat talks on YouTube, as the whole world is waiting impatiently? They're not the whole world. I know Mr. Trump is not waiting at all to listen to me. He doesn't listen to anybody. I read that some hospitals, but they all get put up on YouTube. I read that some hospitals teach meditation to their cancer patients, help to lessen pain. Is this true? How effective can this be? It is hugely effective. They don't teach meditations to help lessen their pain. They teach it to get rid of the cancers. Incredibly true. I told you that story at the very beginning. And apparently that Ajahn Bhumai said it in his talk on a Friday ago, so don't mind actually saying it again. Ajahn Bhumai's sister, and she went to my meditation classes in London a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, poor girl, she had breast cancer and it metastasized. So it spread to other places. So that's basically death sentence, basically. Ajahn Bhumai said he gave up on her. But after my retreat, she had a scan. She had 4 tumors before the retreat. After the retreat, 2 tumors, gone, disappeared. And the other 2 tumors had reduced in size by 80% each. That's impressive. There's many stories like that. But because it's Ajahn Bhumai, you know, and it's his sister, that's really beautiful that you could do something for him. And for his sister. So, brilliant. So, yeah, it can be done. I've seen it so many times. That's why all cancer associations, groups, they always try and get some good meditation teachings. If you're watching the Nimitta, can you still hear noise around you? Yes, but the noise is a bit distant. Actually, I said this during some of the... Oh, cracky. I always speak too much. I said this during some of the interviews. What's happening? I mentioned you're subduing the five senses. So usually this is the five senses, high amplitude, because they get most of your attention. The mind, the knowing, is actually quite weak. And it's weak mindfulness as well. So as you meditate, you're subduing the amplitude of the five senses. You're not doing very much. So you're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, actually just get quite subdued. At the same time, you're giving more energy to the mind. Until you get to the time they're about the same level of amplitude. Which means you can still hear, but it's not so hard. It's not so disturbing. And your mind is getting power, so you can start to see nimittas. And so, yeah, the five senses haven't gone yet, but the nimittas is right there. But somebody said, and it's absolutely true, it happens to me, that sometimes, you know, you're wide awake, you're eating your lunch, and you've got this big nimitta in front of you. You've got to eat, you know, through the nimitta, basically, because your mind is so powerful at that particular time. The amplitude is really strong. So, yes, where you're watching the nimitta, you can still hear noise around you, still feel the body. But the stronger the nimitta gets, just the more the body starts to vanish. And when the big nimitta comes, you can't actually... when big nimitta comes, you can't really hear much at all. Where is the previous non-abbot? Is she sick? Oh, non-abbot. Why can't she stay at Dharmasara? Thank you. That's Ajahn Wayama. I went to see her. Yes, she is sick. She needs, like, basically 24/7 care. She's not. Actually, she's amazing just how she's stabilized. So I know she's in good mental state because she laughs at my jokes still. So when I went to see her, I told her a few funny stories. She still laughs. So, you know, she can receive everything. She understands what's going on. But because of her degeneration of the brain, you know, she can't control some of her limbs. So she can't talk. She slurs. And it's really hard for her to try and control her mouth and control some of the other stuff. So because of that, that's why she's staying with Venerable Seri. And she's very well supported. I went to see them, and they're a very happy little couple. They're staying in a nice little house over in, what's it called? Jadebrook, yeah. So if you want to offer dharma to them, you can go and see them. So that's actually... I don't know why that happened, but I think it was probably because it was just too hard for her in those years. You know, she really enjoyed a lot. Maybe too much. Dear Ajahn, the recent retreat videos are not available on YouTube. Do you know where we can watch them when practicing at home? They're coming soon. Apparently, we've got a new website, and we have all those ready to upload, but they haven't been uploaded yet. So it's just developing a totally new website for the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, which makes it easier. I think they're pretty close to actually finishing it, so... should be coming up in the next couple of months. I hope. Thanks for giving the opportunity for the nuns yesterday. They are brilliant and did a great job. I must say you got a very, very good deal on eBay. Well, does the nuns monastery still need more money? Because if that's the case, we can sell one of them. Put them an offer. Yeah, they're very good nuns. That is really important. You can build a monastery, you can build a retreat center, but that's not really important. Building people is really important. Because that's one of Ajahn Chah, what he said to me personally just a few weeks, I think, before he couldn't speak anymore. And it was just one of those sayings you'll always remember. He said in his life he'd built many monasteries, but he hadn't built many monks. You understand what he meant? And so I remembered that. So I think, make sure you build monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. That's more important than buildings. What's the point of the buildings when you haven't got any people who really understand what they're there for and make use of them? So... building people is really important. So, I'm glad that you think that the nuns which have been built up so far are very high quality products. Just give us a few more years and then we'll release them. on you all. They can start doing these retreats and the Friday night talks, but we don't release them yet. They've got to really be trained and get their confidence up. And then once they're good enough, that's when I stamp them, QC, quality control, certified by Ajahn Brahm, allowed to go out and teach other people. QC. So anyway, they're really good. But if you actually get them, push them too fast, like push any monk too fast, sometimes it destroys them. So that when they're ready. Why Jataka stories are not used very much for Dhamma teachings in the West? They are confirmed to books only, unlike the Eastern, whatever. Your comments. The Jataka, some Jataka tales are great, but other ones you can't really understand them because they're all about chariots and oxes and kings. And, you know, sometimes that doesn't make any sense to us. But some of them are great. One of my favourite Jataka tales is, I haven't said this one for a while, about a minister who would always talk too much. Now, that's very common in Parliament. Some people, as soon as they go on the microphone, they can't stop speaking. And sometimes that happens whenever you, you know, have a meeting in our city centre. Someone gets on the microphone and they just hog it all the time. They're supposed to be asking a question, but they don't ask one. They give a Dhamma talk. And how can you stop these people? So this king had a minister who was like that, would never stop. Once he started speaking, he would not stop. Which meant no business got done in court, and this poor king was at his wit's end, know what to do with this really talkative minister. And he was just walking in his garden, and he saw something really interesting. The kids had just come out of school, and there was this man in a wheelchair. Because, you know, he was disabled, he couldn't get a proper job. So what he was actually doing to earn a living, he'd have what we call his pea shooters, a little tube in which you put little peas, dried peas, and you would blow it, and the pea would go at very high velocity. And he would aim it at bushes and trees, and the kids would give him a few pennies, can you make a rooster, can you make an elephant? And he was so skillful, and he would sculpt the bush into being like a chicken, like a rooster, or he could make it like a peacock. He was that skilled and that fast with the pea shooter, and that's actually how he made his living. And the king had this amazing idea. And so he went up to this disabled man, whispered in his ears, saying that you don't have to work for pennies anymore. I can employ you and just give you a really comfortable life for the rest of your years. And the disabled man agreed. So the next morning, in the court, when all the ministers came in front of the king. No one noticed there was a new curtain against one of the walls. But when they started the business about, say, taxation, this minister started opening his mouth. At taxation, I'm an expert on taxation, and this is what I think we should do. And as soon as he opened his mouth, he felt something hit the back of his throat. And he gulped it down like you would. And now, I think that we should... Nope. And I think we should, nope. But I think that we should not, nope. We should not tax businesses, nope, because they employ people, nope. But we should tax the workers, nope. And he was so talkative that nothing would stop him. And as he was talking, all this stuff was, you know, what it was hitting the back of his throat and was gulping it down. He started to feel a bit sort of sick inside his tummy. Gulp. And the more he gulped down, just the more queasy he got. And he started going green in the face. And he was really getting very, very sick. Until, gulp, one more gulp. And he couldn't stand it any longer. He put his hand over his mouth. He ran out to the toilet to vomit. And at that, the king burst out laughing. And he opened the curtain. Of course, behind the curtain was this disabled man in his wheelchair with his pea shooter. But he didn't have peas. He had this big bag, mostly used up, of chicken shit. These little pellets which fit perfectly into a pea shooter. And every time this minister opened his mouth, he got another pellet of chicken shit. Oh, straight down into his tummy. No wonder he got sick. And that solved the problem. So the minister never turned up for about 3 or 4 days. They got a lot of business done while he was away. And when he did come back, he'd hardly speak. And when he did, he'd always put his hand over his mouth before he spoke. And if you see people like you putting their hand over their mouth when they speak, that's where it comes from. They're afraid that behind some curtain somewhere, behind some door, there's a guy with a pea suit and a big bag of chips. That's in the Jardikas. Well, that's a story which I'd love. I love telling that one. But yeah, some of them are really funny stories. You mentioned compassion many times, but you never mentioned its cultivation. Does compassion arise from deep meditation? Yes. What is the root source of compassion, stillness, and selflessness? Is it in our innate nature? Yes, but it is obstructed by your own needs and desires, and what you want comes first. So you haven't really got any space for compassion for others. And it also comes from a lack of wisdom as well. When you understand what compassion is may all beings be happy and well, if they want to. First of all beings includes you. So it's not other beings. That's what some people mean. May other beings be happy and well. May other beings be free of suffering. But what about you? You're one of those beings. So it must always include you. When I say all beings, it includes you. And also, as I mentioned earlier, just saying that may all beings be happy and well, that's not compassion. Because some beings don't want to be happy and well. And they've got a right to be miserable. And I will support people's right to be miserable and sad and unwell. If that's what they want, I will support you. Freedom. Human rights. So, these days, I say, may all beings be happy and well, if they want to. I'm not a control freak anymore. Compassion. And the door of my heart will be open to you, even if you're misery guts, even if you're angry, even if you're a real B-A-S-D-A-R-D, the door of my heart will still be open to you. So that's compassion. Anyway, trying to remember one's earliest memories of previous life. When is it best to do this? Soon after coming out of meditation, any other time? You have to have a really good meditation to be able to do that. Maybe nimittas. Nimittas are best. And you've been with a nimitta for a long time. You've got energy. You've got power. You realize your mind is able to do stuff. And then give it a try. And if your mind is ready, straight away something will come up. If you wait even for 2 or 3 seconds, it's not going to happen. So the mind becomes, you can feel that. When you get into deep meditation, you find your mind can do whatever you want. It has that strength to it. And you can actually feel that. So don't try and fool yourself when you know it's not really ready for it. Thank you for the conducive place for meditation. Great rooms, delicious food, excellent bushwalks, beautiful weather, and inspirational millipedes. No, talks. How are we not to want more and not crave for it? Because when you want more, you just destroy. That great saying, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So you make a beautiful food from Bianca. You say, if there's just a tiny bit more soy sauce in this will be perfect. That's wanting more, which means you can't enjoy what you have. Look at this place here. If the cushions were just a little bit more soft, then it would be perfect. And now you're destroying your happiness. If it could only just be an extra couple of days, it would be perfect. I'm just so close. Can we just please extend it for 2 more days? That's suffering. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your wisdom. May you attain parinibbana. I will not follow your orders. I am independent. If you say, may I attain, I'm probably just out of principle not. Just to show my independence. I'm only messing around. Sometimes people say that. Have a wonderful day. And I say, no. I am not going to follow your orders. I'm a monk. I don't follow what lay people tell me to do. You say, have a wonderful day. Just in principle, I'll have a miserable day just to spite you. I'm not going to be controlled by anybody. Anyway, dear Ajahn, Catholics can do bad things all their lives, then repent and get absolution from their whatever, her priest. That's absolutely true. There's this story I read about this Catholic, and when he was a kid, he was always wanted a bicycle. And he prayed and prayed and prayed to God and Jesus, I don't know which one, for a bicycle. He prayed and prayed, nothing came. So one day he decided to steal one and then ask forgiveness. He said, that's how it's done. Because that's what you can do. You do something bad, and then you ask forgiveness, and Jesus forgives you. That was actually funny when I read it. Anyway, that's not what happens. It's karma. You still go to jail. So, what can Buddhists do to erase their bad karma? Number one, don't do any in the first place. That's the best to make sure that you can erase bad karma. Number two, you can dilute bad karma. The Buddha said the simile of the spoon of salt. If you take a spoon of salt and you put it into a cup, you can't, a cup of water, you can't drink the water, it's too salty. But if you put the same spoon of salt into the lake down there and stir it up, you won't even notice the taste has changed. Because there's so much fresh water there, it's all diluted. Same with karma. If you've done a little bit of bad karma, then you can dilute it with good karma. Which is very helpful telling that story when you want to raise donations for the nuns' monastery. Because people have always done some bad karma. It reminds me of the other story about this kid. And he went to school and he said, I'm really sort of short of money. My father won't give me any pocket money. What should I do? And one of his friends said, oh, it's really easy. Look, your elder sister's over there. Just go to your elder sister and just tell her, sister, I know all about it. Because everyone's got some guilt, some secrets. So he went up to his sister and says, sister, I know all about it. He said, who told you? He said, well, you know, the kids in the school. But just don't tell mum and dad, okay? $20, and I won't tell mum and dad. So his sister gave him $20. Because no one actually, you don't know if they know or not. They've all got some secrets. So he thought, this is a really nice little learner. So when he wanted a bit more money, he went up to his mum and said, mum, I know all about it. He said, what? How come? She said, well, you know, some of the kids at school, you know, they know your friends. So I know all about it, mum. Just don't tell dad, okay? Here's $50. When he wanted some more money, he asked, told his father. He asked his father, dad, I know all about it. Oh, God, how did you know, you pest? At school, you know, lots of kids at school, you know, we talk. Don't tell your mother, okay? You promise you won't tell your mother? It'll cost you $100, Dad, and I won't tell Mum. Anything less, she gets to hear. So he gives $100. So he's a really nice little learner. And then, wondering what else he could do, you know, so he goes to the postman. Postman comes every day. He goes up to the postman and said, postman, postie, I know all about it. And the poster looks at him and said, son. It's a bit of adultery there, but anyway. So, if I said to you before we collected donations, I know all about it, Wendy. I know all about it, Pia. Ooh, how much I jump up. But we don't play games like that. So, and the other way to overcome bad karma is understand there's nobody in there. Really understand. Penetrate non-self. Become a stream winner. And straight away, a lot of bad karma is let go of. You can't let go of that. It just disappears when non-self is seen. Anyway, you said that Lord Buddha looked just like any other monks. Have read that he was extremely good looking, with golden skin and Aryan features. Which is the correct description? People always tend to exaggerate their teacher. That's called, what's it called, hagiography. So what that really means, we always want our teacher to be wiser than other people's teachers. And so sometimes that may be the same with you. So I've just been on Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm's no good. I went to Pahok. Pahok's much better. Pahok, no, he's just so last decade. I went to this new teacher. And it's, you know, spiritual materialism as well. So we always tend to exaggerate the abilities of our teachers. So, extremely good looking, maybe when he was young, but everybody, when they get old, including the Buddha, they start to get wrinkled skin. And as the Buddha said, just like his body held together like an old cart with straps. So, and there's too many stories of people who were looking for the Buddha. When he was very old, there was another story. King Ajatasattu was taken by his doctor, Jivaka, to the bamboo grove, went inside the hall, and the king had to ask, which one is the Buddha? Which one is it? Point him out. He said, that one over there sitting against the pillar facing east. So there's so many stories that, you know, it didn't stand out. You know, he looked just like one of the other monks, and the king had to be told which one it was. Much gratitude for the nuns' inspirational stories. The pond visualization helped me go to deep meditation day. Thank you to the nun in orange. Which is it? No, it's the pond. What's the pond visualization? So you jump in the lake. Okay. Sorry. No, good. Thank you. I'm a naughty monk, but you encourage me by laughing. Is it a good idea to meditate at the corner of the bedroom? It might build up the energy in this corner that will have the effect not to sleep well. Thank you. Now, if you do that, just use a corner of a bedroom, say, as your meditation area. As long as you meditate there, your bed is where you sleep, the corner is where you meditate. You separate the two, and usually the energy and the psychology is different. So you can sleep on your bed. You won't be able to sleep in that corner. Thank you so much for being you. I've got no choice. I have achieved nothing on this retreat. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Nothing is better than anything. But my sense of contentment and happiness has grown, as has my mindfulness. Colors are brighter, the trees seem more lovely, the food is tastier, people are more beautiful, and your jokes seem funnier. At last, some appreciation. And sure sign of greatly increased mindfulness. But in no long time this will be shot to pieces. All my energy and happiness will diminish shortly after the retreat. Any tips on how to develop some evenness in our practice? You can't keep life even. It always changes, light and darkness, you know, summer and winter time. It'd be lovely if you can keep the weather even. Now, sometimes it's too cold in this place, sometimes it's too hot. Imagine just get it just in the middle. That'd be just perfect, right? But you can't have that. So what you do, you go home and you lose a lot of this energy, but please, you can keep the pot warm. It doesn't get really icy cold by doing a bit of meditation at home. And that means that when you come to the retreat the next time, you don't have to start from scratch. You've already kept a little bit from last time, a little seed, so the next time you come on a retreat, you can take it further. And then you go and you go backwards, but you don't go to square one again. Every time you just maintain a higher level. Aha! Another deep question. Da 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 da. Was it this way around? Oh, it's a Muslim sign. No, it's a funny face. Two eyes, a nose, and a crescent moon. It's a smiley face. Is it true that regardless of what we do in our lifetime, it's our last thought that determines where we are reborn? Yes and no. Yeah, your last thought is important, but your last thought is conditioned by everything you do in your lifetime. If you've been a scallywag all your lifetime, if you've been selfish and greedy and nasty, you can't suddenly think of your last thought, may all beings be happy and well. You can't do that. Your last thought is the sum total of everything you've done in your whole lifetime. When one has experienced betrayal and deception from a spouse of many years, how does one treat them with loving kindness and move on? It's because they are going to suffer. They've hurt you. Now, the law of karma means that you don't need to seek revenge. One of my sayings, it's a coarsely worded saying, but because it's coarsely worded, people remember it. No need to seek revenge. Karma will get the bastard anyway. So say it like that, people actually remember it. I get into trouble because you shouldn't say those words, but it's a teaching tool. And it is really true because, you know, you've betrayed, deceived, your ego wants to get revenge on them. But you don't need to. Karma will sort that one out. Your job is not to let their bad actions take away your happiness. So you have the choice there. You can treat them with loving kindness and move on. That is your choice. That is your freedom. You don't have to be the punisher. They will cop it for what they've done. So that is how you can actually treat them with some loving kindness. It's in your interest to do so. Dear Ajahn Brahm, since the Buddha's time, the population of the human species has exploded. Exactly. That's the biggest problem with climate change. You know, you could say about too many fossil fuels, but you know, we're a fossil fuel. We, too many people on this planet, overpopulation. And that's why I say, I am doing my bit to reduce overpopulation by being a monk. I think to reduce the population, we should have every third person being a monk or a nun, all sponsored by the governments. They spend a lot of money, and we should get carbon credits for being a monastery because we are lessening, you know, our progeny, which means less people, less carbon footprint. So this is my solution to achieving the goals of the Paris Agreement. More monasteries. That's a good idea. But you have to ordain before you have kids, not afterwards, otherwise it doesn't count. Since the Buddha's time, there has not, however, been a corresponding growth in enlightened teachers of the Dhamma. How do you know? The result, demand for enlightened teacher far exceeds their supply. Yes. So when the demand exceeds the supply, that is a great opportunity for making profits in economics. Isn't that the case? Demand. So, and with all the best teachers taking R&R in Nibbana, the problem is only getting worse. No, I'm doing something about it. I'm making more teachers. This is, I call it, a monk factory and a nun factory. That's what we do here in Dharmasara. It's the nun factory. We get the raw material in. We just turn the conveyor belts. And out at the other end of the sausage machine comes great teacher nuns. That's what Bodhinyana Monastery is. You can see, you know, out of the sausage machine of Bodhinyana Monastery, already popped out Ajahn Bhamali, and many other sort of products are coming online soon. So this is our factory. For the demand for great teachers. It's getting worse now, I'm doing something about it. Can we therefore humbly request you out of boundless compassion to forgo your Nibbana retirement plan and maintain just enough karma in your superannuation to cover the cost of a return flight to Perth after your death so the next generation can also be subject to the wisdom of bad jokes? A concerned citizen of Perth, they say. No, you don't have a choice in this. It's not my choice. So I can't do anything about it. So anyway, so you want me to, you know, that's a dangerous thing to ask people to pull off their Nibbana. But this is a true story, but it shows you how scallywags monks can be. Because this was apparently a story written in Alexander David Neil's book about Tibet. Because some of these monks, you know, some of them, they became monks when they're very young, and they really went into it when they get old. And so, you know, they wanted to get a wife. But how can you become a wife when you're a monk? And they came up with this really good, really scoundrel plan. So they went to their local village, and they said, "My meditation is very deep. I'm so close to enlightenment. This will probably be my last birth." The monk would say to the local village. And they'd say, "Oh, please, no. We need you back again in your next life. Please don't go to enlightenment. Please come back again." And the monk would say, "Well, it's a bit too late now. Is there nothing we can do?" "Well, I'd have to do something really bad." "Oh, please do something." "It has to be very, very bad." "Oh, please, venerable monk, out of compassion, do something very, very bad." And that's what they did. He said, "Well, you know, I have to get married. Now, who's the most beautiful girl in the village? I'll take her. And they think, that's a really bad thing for a monk to do. But he said, well, I'm not doing this out of from lust. I'm doing it out of compassion for you so I can come back again in my next life. And so he disrobes, gets married to the girl he likes. And they also think, oh, what a compassionate person he is. Now that is such a scallywag. But people buy that rubbish. And they said to Alexander David Neil, so he saw a lot of monks like that, ex-monks. And they were so respected in the village. They said, oh, they weren't bad monks because they disrobed and got married. They were really good monks because they pull off their enlightenment out of concern for others. So I really be really careful. Some of the dodges and the scams which you can sometimes come across. So I'm sorry, it's not up to me anymore. Dear Ajahn, his roundness Brahma Donut. Brahma Donut, okay. What are your plans for the next few months? Are you travelling much? Yours, Nosy Parker. Yes, tomorrow I'm already travelling. Over the road back to monastery. So, you only live in the moment. Yeah, I'm supposed to be travelling to Kuala Lumpur soon, but I don't know when, sometime soon. Try to live in the present moment, for goodness sake. Thank you, Bianca, for mothering us throughout this retreat. Sadhu, she's still here, she's gone. She's gone, oh crikey, this is for tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, if you think it's appropriate, could you please mention Sutta Central as another worthy cause for donations? I heard they need funding. Yeah, but really, Sutta Central, that's Ajahn Sujato. I prefer funding monasteries because there's not enough teachers. So I like getting monk and nun factories. That's what I like doing. And there's too many monk and nun factories need the money. Sutras, I prefer them in the Pali anyway. That's the best. Thank you, Ajahn Brahma and Bianca, for a wonderful retreat. That's for tomorrow. You said not to believe what you said. So I touched the Buddha in the pagoda. Who was this one? The next day, my ex-boyfriend flew back frantically from overseas to look for me, but couldn't find me. Could I touch the other Buddha pagoda and get a second opinion on true love? Seriously. That was just a joke. You said not to believe what you said, so I touched the Buddha in the pagoda. The next day, my ex-boyfriend flew back frantically from overseas to look for me, but couldn't find me. Could I touch the other Buddha pagoda and get a second opinion on true love? That's very funny. Seriously, is there such a thing as true love? Are all men and women the same? Exactly. True love only lasts for a couple of years, and then reality strikes. If one decides to end his or her life because of terminal illness, would that person accumulate a bad karma? What would be the rebirth process after euthanasia? Euthanasia is not the problem. Youth all over the world is the problem. Youth in Asia is not the problem. Youth, oh, you're really getting tired and dull. Now, you end your own life, it really depends upon your intention. Karma depends upon your intention. So if you really do it out of kindness, compassion, then it's not bad karma. And one of the examples of that, the first person, I think, in the world who did legally assisted voluntary euthanasia, Mr. Dent. He was a Buddhist from Northern Territory, from Darwin. And he did assisted voluntary euthanasia because he had so much compassion for his wife. He said he didn't mind sort of carrying on, even though he had no quality of life, 24/7 care. His wife insisted on being the one who cared for him. She had no life at all. And so he decided to do voluntary euthanasia. His main intention was to give his wife some freedom. They can argue with his wife, try and say, look, leave me alone, get some respite. She said, no, it's my job. So the only way to free her, he thought, was to take voluntary euthanasia. Become the first person legally to do that. And so, knowing that intention, you can't really fault it. The last question. How do I know whether the nimitta I see is due to letting go and not through will? Someone told me that if it's due to will, you never get far with the nimitta. It will not lead you to jhanas. Yeah, and it's hard. It's not soft and joyful. So if it's a nimitta which really comes from letting go, it's joyful, it's soft, and it's beautiful. And the next stage of letting go to get into the jhanas, then that will be easy for you. If you've got it through willpower, making it happen, then you won't be able to go to the last stage of letting the nimitta go to enter a jhana. So, you don't do things through will, you do it through letting go. And now is the time for me to let you go. So you can, many of you will go to the letting go room. You know the letting go room? That's called the toilet. And tomorrow, please make sure that you pay respects to the letting go box. You know the letting go box? What's the letting go box? Yeah, let go. Okay, so have a wonderful night and let go into a nice, calm, beautiful sleep. Now this, nuns, is how you're supposed to do the three sadhas. Pay attention and listen, otherwise I will not pass you from the Dhammasara factory to actually go out and teach. Okay, you're going to get a lot of oof. Oof. Sadhu. 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 That's how it's done. Now, your turn. Okay, never mind. Okay. You don't have to. Okay, good night, everybody. See you in the morning.